you know, that, for example, that that was a PSECU card, and they were, you know, there are all sorts of ways that that could work, and that's part of the concern. What we're asking Congress to do, and I was actually in Pennsylvania Senator Casey's office just this past Wednesday, asking his legislative assistant to talk to the senator about, there's a Senate bill, 575, which asks the Congress to delay the implementation of the Durbin Amendment, which is currently scheduled for implementation on July 21st this year, to delay the implementation, give the Federal Reserve 2 years to study this, and then come back with a new approach on this. There was, again, no time to study the Durbin Amendment before it was put into the law, and we just think that there should be some more thoughtful consideration. This is one of those situations, Rick, where the unintended consequences, you know, I understand what they're trying to do to help merchants out, but I just don't think that I agree with what you started to say at one point, where I'm not sure that consumers are going to see the benefit of this.
Well, that's just what I was going to ask you. I mean, this I kind of get the idea that the banks collect those fees and then are able to offer free checking accounts.
That's exactly
and the cards
right.
And all of that.
Well, and what we've seen since the Durbin Amendment was included in the Dodd-Frank bill is banks coming out introducing higher fees on services. There, you know, on the subject of merchants passing these funds back to consumers, that's just not true. I think that this is the way that this legislation was kind of sold to the Congress. But in a recent conference call with investors, the CFO of Home Depot explained that the Durbin Amendment would add about $35 million a year to their company's bottom line. My question is, well, I thought that was going back to consumers.
Well, that never happens.
What, of course not. Walmart, Rick, will benefit about $250 million a year from the Durbin Amendment.
Now, yeah, I'm definitely not in favor of that.
Well, it may show up on the consumer side, but then again, I've got a feeling, you know, these are all, you know, publicly traded companies. Their mission is to maximize shareholder value. That
right.
That money's going to the bottom line.
Sure. Now, this is just debit cards. This isn't credit cards.
That's correct.
Because here's my problem with this, Greg. You know, I got to be honest. I don't have a debit card.
Sure.
I either use credit card or cash.
Right.
So with these debit card transactions, could it work where you put how much it's going to cost to use the debit card? Because I got to be honest, I'm a firm believer in going back to cash and doing away with a lot of credit cards either, because I think credit cards, they get you into trouble.
They some people have difficulty managing credit cards. And, you know, some of the banks, Rick, have actually proposed that, you know, if they're not going to get the larger rate of interchange on their cards, they may restrict the use of the card to either $50 or $100. In other words, you wouldn't be able to, if you had a debit card, wouldn't be able to use your card for a purchase for more than that amount. And what that could end up doing is forcing consumers back into cash, cash isn't the safest thing to carry around. At least if you lose your card or if it's used inappropriately, you're protected against that transaction.
Right.
But then again, pushing people over into credit cards, like we were saying, not everybody can manage a credit card, you know, and sometimes, you know, The idea right now, you know, after the financial crisis of 2008 was for people to kind of get their house in order. I'm not sure that boosting their credit card balances is in alignment with that.
Right. So I got to be honest, I'm on your side on this. I'm not on the side of Walmart and the big box retailers, because I do know that the fees that we're already paying them are just going to go into their pocket.
Yeah.
There's going to be no change there. So basically what you want people to do is call Senator Toomey and Senator Casey
Senator Toomey actually is already a co-sponsor on the legislation, Senate Bill 575. Senator Casey, we're still trying to persuade. One final point, Rick, if I could. Senator Casey, when he was the treasurer for the state of Pennsylvania, was a real advocate against payday lenders. You started the segment with information about payday lenders. When I was in his office this last week, I showed him some stock price charts for major payday lenders that are publicly traded on either the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. And, Rick, it's amazing. If you look at their price action since July 22nd when Dodd-Frank was signed, some of these stocks have gone up. I'm looking at one. The company is Easy Corp. It's traded under the symbol EZPW. On July 22nd, it was a $20 stock. This last week, it was a $32 stock. Another company is First Cash Advance, symbol FCFS, traded on the NASDAQ. $23 stock on July 22nd, $38 stock today. What the market is saying with this is they know that millions of Americans are going to be pushed out of banks because the banks are going to raise their fees on their unprofitable customers. They're not going to have the revenue from interchange anymore. Those consumers, those Americans are going to be forced into the arms of the payday lenders. When some poor guy doesn't have milk for his kids and he needs $300 or whatever before payday, he's going to go out and pay 300, 400, 500% APR just to bridge that gap.
And like I said, those are the kind of rates that would make a loan shark fly.
Absolutely. But those are standard rates in that industry, Rick.
Well, I mean, it's because, years ago, I remember Bernie Sanders saying, we need to put usury rates back on.
Yeah.
We need to cap things at 30, 40, 50%.
I understand.
And couldn't do it.
It's just
insane. And I can't believe that we allow it to happen. That's what bothers me.
Yeah. Well, it hurts the people that can least afford it. It's just not right, and that was the point I was trying to make when I was in Casey's office. That
was he receptive?
I didn't speak to the senator, but I did speak with his legislative assistant Jennifer McCloskey, and she was very understanding of the situation. She knew the issue, but she said it would be the senator's decision finally. And if you're listeners are inclined to support us on this, I would sure hope that they would either give a phone call to Senator Casey's office or, consider going on his website and lobbying him for his support of Senate Bill 575.
Well, we'll get a link up on our site where they can get to the senator's office. I got to be honest with you. I have a visceral reaction to supporting anything that the big banks want.
But in balancing
Walmart and big banks, it's I guess on this one I'm gonna come down here.
Rick, we talked before. We don't line up with the big banks very often either. When they were opposed to the Credit Card Act of 2009, we supported the passage of that legislation. When they were opposed to new overdraft rules that the Federal Reserve was proposing and did eventually implement, we supported those. The banks lost billions of dollars on that, and we were happy for consumers to see that type of legislation passed.
Personally, I don't know why anybody would go to a bank, but that's their choice. Greg Smith, president of PSECU, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Here's a bit of political trivia for you. Three of the goofiest, most anti-worker governors in America are named Rick. What are the odds of that? They are Scott of Florida, Snyder of Michigan, and Perry of Texas. But all three Ricardos are in danger of being out-goofified by Paul LePage of Maine. He's the right-wing extremist who slipped into the governor's chair last fall after a three-way race in which he got a mere 38% of the vote. Rather than show a bit of humility, however, this minority governor has pumped himself up with high-octane hubris and gone on a tear against the state's workaday majority. His rampage includes busting unions, rolling back child labor laws, gutting programs for the middle class and poor, and raising the retirement age for Maine workers, all in his first few weeks in office. Then, in late March, LePage made his grab for gold-plated goofy greatness. As widely reported, the potentate of the Pine Tree State ordered that a 36-foot-wide mural be removed from the State Department of Labor. The work of art depicts historical scenes of Maine workers, but it seems that the Gov and certain unnamed corporate backers found the painting too favorable toward laboring people. So, poof, it was summarily disappeared into a storeroom. With chance of put it back and recall Paul, the public has roundly ridiculed LePage as the right-wing's official decorator-in-chief. But now, he's really been stung by the U.S. Labor Department. It seems that the mural was largely paid for by a federal grant during George W. Bush's regime, and the feds are now dunning LePage's regime either to pay back the money or reinstall the artwork. This is Jim Hightower saying, this autocrat ran against big government last year, but now he is big government and way too big for his britches.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
The key word there being crazy. Anyway, according to Michelle Bachmann, Planned Parenthood in Illinois wants to become the lens crafter of big abortion. I'm not making this up. You got to wonder. It's no wonder that women everywhere are scrambling to Planned Parenthood. In fact, pro-choice groups have seen an unprecedented surge in activism in recent weeks, with online gifts to Planned Parenthood jumping 500% since people like Bachmann and other Republicans have targeted women's health providers with budget cuts. Meanwhile, NAREL, the Pro-Choice America's email list, has grown by 1,000 subscribers per day. Think about that. And you know what's interesting? I think, you know, because Bachmann is really the T-Twister candidate for president. No doubting that. In fact, I think she's even out-cuckoo-cadooed Sarah Palin. Here's the interesting part. I think mainstream America is bored with the whole T-Twit dog and pony show, because according to a recent national survey conducted by the Pew Research Center, 29% of Americans disagree with the Tea Party, 22% agree, and 49% could really give a rat's behind. So for all the lip service, all that lip service about the T-Twits and their ranks, you know, which are basically stagnant, you know, having all this power and we're going to shut the government down. Actually, people who are against them have risen. The independent voters are now seeing them as the kooks that they are. 15% rise. Back in March, 14% of independent voters said they disagreed with the T-Twists. Today, 27%. And you'll remember not too long ago, back in March, a CNN opinion research poll released then said just about 22% viewed Tea Party favorably, 47% negatively. So, I mean, I think people are waking up and going, the star is gone. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Got Helen on line one. How are we doing tonight, Helen?
Hi, dear. I had a question for the guy from the credit union. The welfare people get their benefits with an EBT card,
right,
which is like a debit card, and I was wondering how this is going to affect them, because I'm sure some bank handles it for the state of Pennsylvania. I'm sure it's not something we do in-house. And my daughter-in-law, who is working not on welfare, she gets child support, as do others from the local, you know, child support bureau with a credit, a debit card, excuse me. Every time they withdraw money, I think it costs them $2 or something, so they have to withdraw it all at one time.
Right. That's the fixed rate that they have for unemployment checks or any of the other stuff.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it's going to cost more for them or if it's going to stay the same. I really think it's horrible that, you know, somebody that desperately needs it, like somebody that gets child support or somebody on welfare, has to pay this fixed rate.
I'm under the impression that, now, this is my view on this, and I'm pretty sure I'm right, that if you take money out of your account with the welfare, if you use it at the stores, that is free. But if you do any, like, balance checking or any of the other stuff, that costs money. I think that's negotiated with the state, and I think they pay a flat fee.
Okay.
But I will get you an answer to that, and I'll ship you off an email when I get the answer to it.
Okay, because I'm sure, you know, the people, I don't know how many people who would be interested or listening, but for your information, a friend of mine came down to some meeting that her reunion had. She's a counselor with the prison, and they were down in Mechanicsburg on Saturday. So I wore the shirt that Mike bought me. And, you know, was telling everybody, do you listen to the Rick Smith Show?
I appreciate
it. And I told them you had the 866 number so they could call from up in their area. So hopefully some of them will start listening.
I appreciate it. It's an 888 number, but that's okay.
Okay, well, they'll figure it out when they go online.
Thanks so much, Ellen. I appreciate it.
Sure.
All right. You know, this whole debit thing, you know, again, you know, it's a balancing act. You know, do you want to give the money to the big box retailers? Or are you going to give it to the banks? Now, the credit unions, they need the money. And I'm a big fan of credit unions. Anybody who's listened to this show knows. I don't even have all my stuff is through the credit unions. That's where I do my banking. So it only goes to show that I can't stand Bank of America or any of the big transnational banks. And I don't know why anybody would be part of one of those.
No, it's not just the transnationals. I mean, the local banks that have merged over the years. I mean, where I live, I come from a small town, and my bank has changed about 5 times, and every time it merged with another bank, the fees went up. So I understand your aversion. I mean, I had that aversion, too. I still deal with that, but I also belong to a credit union. In the long run, you're better off with a credit union without question.
Yeah. Anyway... back to what we were talking about with the tea twizzlers. Mother Jones asked an interesting question in their article, who owns the Tea Party? And it's an interesting question because it's kind of become a really bizarre fight here. And the story goes, you know, basically tells the story of this guy back in April 2009. His name's Barry Cole. He went to one of these tea twit rallies in his hometown of Wichita, Kansas, and he saw an opportunity. Like a good entrepreneur, he saw a chance to exploit a bunch of idiots, and, you know, who had money and who would buy a bunch of, you know, crappy jingoistic sloganeering junk, you know, hats, underwear, you know, whatever. And so, like a good capitalist, he went and he applied for, just got his trademark named Tea Party Patriot. And went on the internet, went on eBay, started hawking this cheap junk. A couple of months later, according to Mother Jones, Mr. Cole got a cease and desist letter from a lawyer representing the Tea Party Patriots. You know, the big spontaneous grassroots group with the fancy buses and all that. The big Koch brothers supported, billionaire supported grassroots operation. Remember them? They accused Mr. Cole of committing trademark violations. Another smart opportunist, a radio host in Orlando, said, you know, he saw an opportunity, gobbled up the website, teapartypatriots.com. Another guy in Washington State goes, hey, I got that idea, teaparty-patriots.com. Another person went on this site called Zazzle and, you know, started saying, hey, you can buy your stuff from us because, you know, we're the Tea Party Patriot people. Another one of their lawsuits. And what I find interesting is, you know, the Tea Party is supposed to be about individual freedom and liberty and the ability to do whatever you want without having government come down on you. And exactly what the Tea Party is is trying to say government is going to do, this private for-profit entity, is doing to them, and I'm glad, because this is exactly what I've been saying. I'm not so much worried about government. We can vote those people out. We can put other people in. It's these for-profit, private, secretive organizations who do stuff like this, take you into court and bankrupt you because of lawsuits. Not that government can't do that, but it's these folks that bother me. And what's interesting to me, and it's kind of one of those moments where there's a moment of clarity. Michelle Bachmann was talking about their agenda. You know, they're pro this or that, and you know, we love fetuses and all that agenda. And she was talking about the courts, you know, because those activist judges, you know, like the ones who, you know, make collective bargaining illegal. Those activist judges, you know, we need to rein them in. And she had a really interesting statement that I just kind of grabbed me. Listen to this. Now, understand, it's one of those moments where you go, is she just nuts or is it me? But listen to this. Well, evidently not. This thing just is. Here we go. Nope, not tonight. Anyway, she goes on to say that we have within our authority the ability to decide what judges can...
within our authority to decide what judges can rule on and what they can't.
Like she said, what judges have, what they can rule on and what they can't. We have the authority to decide. And I went back and I read Article 3 of the Constitution, and I have no idea what the hell she's talking about. I'm sorry, I'm just, you know, I understand that, you know, the lower courts, they have the ability to kind of shape that, but the Supreme Court, I'm sorry, I'm kind of missing that. Kind of missing it completely. But then again, crazy is what crazy does. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, back after this.
Tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go there and download our program. There for your entertainment, your enjoyment. And we'd love to hear from you. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can give us a call here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Brandon emailed me, asked about tax fairness. He says, correct me if I'm wrong, as a working class person, I earn $40,000 per year, just an example, in wages. The total percentage of taxes that I pay to federal, state, and city are higher than the total taxes that ExxonMobil, GE, New York City, Mike Bloomberg, and Donald Trump would pay on their total annual revenue. I already know that if a rich person earns the same amount of income, $40,000 a year, in stock dividends, they pay a max 15%. But I'm talking about the income they receive from their businesses. What I want to know is if I'm being accurate when I assert that rich pay lower in taxes, the rich pay lower in taxes as percentage of taxes on their total income than what I earn in my total earnings. Thanks, Brandon. Look, the majority of stuff that they do, they tie up in stocks and capital gains, things that they can pay the 15% on. Everything else, there are a plethora of loopholes and tax dodges that they can use, shelters, all kind of stuff that they can use to get away from paying taxes. Now understand, some of the numbers that have come out have put the investor class, you know, those people making over $1 million a year, at paying about 16% of their total wages in taxes, which is lower than someone making $40,000 a year. Now, if you take all the other taxes into account, sales tax and property tax and all of that other stuff, take all that into account, working class people pay a much higher percentage of their income in total taxation. Now, with how the right shifts this, how the crazy Republicans shift this is, well, they pay more money. That's because they have more money, you dimwit. The reality is if you pay if you have $1 billion in taxes and you pay $1 million of it, if you make $1 billion a year, you pay $1 million in taxes. The guy who paid 50% of his $40,000 a year only paid $20,000. Of course, that million is more than $20,000. But as a percentage of income, not even close. And that is the point. They love talking about flat taxes and the level. And to be honest, we would pay a little bit more, but so would they. A little bit more. But we would end up getting screwed in the long run because we're still paying a bunch of other stuff. And you look at what's going on Wall Street right now, and the New York Times pointed this out in their piece, The Drought is Over. They're saying basically the happy days are back, at least for the corner office people. They said after shrinking during the 2008-2009 recession, paychecks for top executives in America are growing again. The chief executives of major corporations like 3M, GE, Cisco are now making as much today as they were before the recession hit. Fourth quarter profits from last year, and we've talked about this a number of times, fourth quarter profits for American businesses were up almost 30%. The fastest growth in more than 60 years. Collectively, American corporations, you know how much they profited last year? $1.678 trillion. That's the profit. Pure profit in their pockets. And what's annoying to me and what's frustrating to me is this recovery on Wall Street and in the boardrooms hasn't trickled down to us like they said it would. If we give them everything, oh, they'll hire us. If we give them almost $1.7 trillion in profit, they're going to hire somebody, right? Well, last I checked, unemployment was still 8.8%. Yet you look at the average CEO of a top 200 corporation in this country, their compensation was nearly $10 million apiece last year, a 12% increase over the year before. The highest paid CEO in the country made $84.5 million in just 9 months. The guy who's the CEO of Viacom. The guy who's the CEO of Occidental Petroleum, over $76 million. An increase of 142%. When was the last time you got a 142% raise? You look at the guy who's the head of the software giant Oracle, over $70 million. Folks, we are not broke. We're not broke. The CEO of Stanley Black & Decker, he saw his increase 253%, up to over $32 million. Emerson Electric CEO saw 233% increase, almost $23 million. You can go down the line and see all of these executives taking huge sums of money. And the vast majority of them have tied it up in the stocks, so they pay virtually nothing, 15%. And this is the best part, Jake. They have the ability to then go and write off all of the stuff they were going to write off before. So they're not even paying 15%.
But they're special, Rick.
Yeah, they're special, all right. They're special in a way because we must be the people who rode the short bus to school. Because we're the ones who are getting stiffed in all this. We're the ones who are seeing our education funding being cut. We're the ones who are seeing this destruction of the middle class, this squeezing of the middle class. And every time I look across the street here in Harrisburg and I see these Republicans going after something else, wanting to destroy something else that the working class people of this country have benefited from, I just want to scream. You know, today I was walking across the street and I ran into a bunch of people who had gone over to the SB1 rally, the voucher rally. You know, they'd come today. It was the people who supported the voucher tax. And I asked one of the groups of people, you know, what is SB1? Why are you here? And they told me, well, this is about child care. And I said, what? Explain that to me. The woman goes, yeah, it's about child care. We want to get child care for our babies. And I said, okay. And then this woman steps in front of us. You know, the people that I'm talking, because there's a crowd of people, this woman steps in front of us and says, you can ask me your questions. So they brought all these people here who don't know the issue, have not a clue. Not a clue. And basically use them as props, put them in powder blue T-shirts. And they don't even know why they're there. This is a handout bill. This is a destruction of education. And they think it's about getting child care.
Well, I can tell you why they wanted the young people there, because they're using the talking points that it is for the children. We want to change the system for the children, Rick.
It's amazing. And I look at those idiots over at the Tinky Tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, who put out this, again, a lie. I guess it can no longer be they're being disingenuous. They're just flat out lying. And this is their release. It's the Commonwealth Foundation announced today preliminary results from extensive open records request that found more than $59 million of taxpayer money is being funneled through taxpayer-funded public school districts directly to organizations frequently involved in lobbying against the interests of taxpayers and underserved children. And they go in and Matt Brillo over there at the Commonwealth Foundation goes into this, well, you know, it's our money going to these people. What he forgets to tell you is that $59 million were dues that came out of wages that teachers and workers earned that paid back to their unions, to a bunch of associations like the Pennsylvania Association for Gifted Children, the Pennsylvania Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, a whole bunch of these stuff, Pupil Services Administrators, Association of Rural and Small Schools, the Association of School Administrators. So all this money that, you know, was coming in to these groups through dues, Brillo over there, seems to think that that's taxpayer money that's being stolen from you. And what he's trying to tell you is, and well, he's not trying, what he is saying is that the government, the evil government, appropriated this money to attack your children. That's what you're supposed to take from this. Understand, this is dues money that workers earned and paid to their associations to lobby on behalf of their interests. But it's kind of a nice way, the way Matt Brillo over there does the lying. It's not even being disingenuous. It's just flat out lying. But truth be told, do we expect any less? No. Mm. And last thing before we go, according to data compiled by FineAid.org, student loan debt has outpaced credit card debt for the first time last year and is likely to top $1 trillion this year. The average student graduates with $24,000 in debt from a four-year college. And we've got a guy who wants to cut 56% of the state funding so that those kids will be saddled with even more debt. Welcome to conservative world. We're right back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Capital rebellions are continuing nationwide as working people defend themselves. Jesse Russell reports.
Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and now Pennsylvania. Hundreds of supporters of collective bargaining rights descended on the Capitol building in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania yesterday to express their discontent with legislation that would make the Keystone State a so-called right-to-work state. Under House Bill 50, public and private sector employees would not be required to be a member of a union if a union represents employees at a workplace. An additional bill would prevent unions from automatically collecting dues from municipal, school district, and state employees. This wasn't the first day of protests seen by Harrisburg. Last week, the halls of the Capitol building were filled with protesters opposed to Governor Tom Corbett's proposals to slash $1.6 billion in funding for schools in the university system. Corbett is trying to address a $4 billion budget shortfall without raising any taxes. The governor made his pledge to not raise taxes during his campaign and is even considering cutting current taxes on businesses.
Activists in Washington State, inspired by Wisconsin's Capitol occupation protests, say that despite being cleared out of their Capitol occupation by police, protesters are still active in Washington and will return in larger numbers Friday. Mark Taylor Canfield is an organizer with Occupy Washington. He says Capitol protesters in Washington State want an end to some tax exemptions for corporations and the wealthy.
And they're up there right now trying to force our state legislators to consider some other options like Senate Bill 5857, which would require the state legislature to review all of these tax exemptions for corporations. I'd like to encourage people to organize and to demonstrate at their own state capital. Of course, you're doing that in Wisconsin, but we'd like to spread the news to the rest of the country to do that as well.
He says rather than balance state budgets by cutting public services needed by low-income and working people, Washington and other state governments need to end unnecessary tax exemptions that benefit the rich so that public services can be maintained. Taylor Canfield urges protesters in all state capitals to organize resistance to these moves to balance budgets on the poor and working people, and he says that Wisconsin protesters who occupied the Capitol in Madison are inspiring and helping protesters in Washington.
So we're consulting with them and also with folks in California who are going to be marching on their state capitol this Friday. At the same time that we're going to be marching there, there's going to be a teabag party at the state capitol in Washington State and in Madison. So we're looking to get as many people as we can out there again.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I'm looking at some of the stuff that's going on across the street and some of the bills that are working their way through. SB1, I think, is just atrocious. HB1, not much better. As it's currently drafted, it provides inadequate protection for victims of negligence when really the a century-old doctrine would suffice. That's why, you know, these are tough, complicated issues. That's why I think people who have a strong understanding of it need to explain it. That's why I've asked Scott Cooper. He's an attorney and also a member of the Pennsylvania Association for Justice to come talk to us a little bit about SB1 and clear some things up. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, there's this thing, joint and several liability. And most people, their eyes just glossed over because they don't know what it is. Can you explain it?
I'll try. Basically, and I think this is, and because it's a legal concept that a lot of people don't understand, it's easy for people like Mike Terzi and Kurt Schroeder to kind of make up lies and just make it seem like it's an unfair doctrine, when in reality, the basic way to explain it to start out with, it's basically a victim safety net. And what it does is protects a victim or a family, if someone in their family is killed, from being left without, you know, uncompensated for losses if more than one defendant is found responsible for causing injuries. The example would be, say you have, I'm a passenger in a car and I'm driving somewhere with someone from work, and the person driving the car goes through a red light. And when they go through the red light, there's also someone driving drunk, and they have a car accident, and I have a really significant injury, say with $100,000 in medical bills and wage loss. If under joint and several liability, if both of those people are, I'd say, you know, the drunk driver shouldn't be driving drunk and the person shouldn't be going through a red light, chances are people would find both drivers 50% at fault.
Right.
If the drunk driver, whose statistics show has a low policy, say $15,000, and the driver has a policy of $100,000, under joint and several liability, the injured victim is going to recover the full amount of the policy limits, $115,000 for both. Under this plan, that's trying to be rammed down everyone's throats, what it would do is it would cut the compensation down for the injured victim to where the $15,000 person, the drunk driver, would pay his limits, but the driver who went through the red light, they only have to pay 50% of their share. The only other way to explain it is I have two kids, and I always tell my children, don't go, you know, be careful who you hang out with, be responsible. If one of my kids is with a pack of friends or something and they break a window and the neighbor comes and says, hey, your daughter broke my window, I'm going to tell my daughter, you got to pay for it.
Right.
And then she says, well, you know, I was with three other girls. And I say, I don't care about the three other girls, you're going to pay for it. And then she says, well, what if the other three can't pay for it? And I say, you've got to pay for it, and that's your problem. And that's really what joint and several liability is making sure that the victim is compensated fully for their losses that a jury's already said you're entitled to.
You know, see, here's the way I understood this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. At the end of this, I see this being where the big corporations get to walk away, the big players figure out a way to weasel their way out. I drove a truck for years.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say I got into an accident and I hurt somebody. I see this as something that could say, well, I caused the accident. I'm the one that gets sued and the company gets off scot-free.
Well, it basically boils down to a big corporate bailout on the back end, and it's letting the victims and the union workers and families hold in the bag on a lot of different levels, which ultimately is going – joint and several liability has actually helped pension plans, the state, and even the tobacco settlement that, you know, the legislature is all happy about because they get to use it, you know, the funds, that was because of joint and several liability.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, the right wing makes this claim that, well, you know, if I'm only half to blame, I should only have to pay half. I shouldn't be responsible. That whole kind of argument, that at least that's what I think they're trying to say.
Well, that's what they say, and that's the talking point. The problem is they don't admit that really what happens is the apportionment is on the back end. So what's happened before any of this apportionment of 50-50 or 60-40 comes into play is a defendant has been held negligent or even reckless. The negligence or recklessness has already then been determined to be a substantial factor in causing the injury. And the plaintiff has also been awarded by the jury money, and one of the other defendants can't pay the full share. So there's a whole bunch of things that have already happened before you even get into this apportionment. And the only reason why there's this apportionment is because the law says you have to apportion into 100% so that a plaintiff doesn't recover more than 100%.
All right. So now everybody's head spinning. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because the Republicans ran on a platform, we're going to create jobs. This is going to – everything we do is about creating jobs. My first question is this something that we need, and two, does it create jobs?
We don't need it. The system works fine as it is. There's no evidence at all, and the Republicans – if you watched anyone who happened to watch the House floor debate yesterday, or there was a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, where people in support of this bill were asked, is there any empirical evidence or data to show that this will create jobs? Is there any, company that's even said if this passes, they'll bring a job into the Commonwealth? And no one was able to support that. Or cite anything. The only thing we've been able to find is I went back and looked at unemployment rates in states that have done joint and several, you know, have done what the Republicans want to do. And going back to 2006, two states in particular, Florida and West Virginia, in 2006 and 2008, both of those states enacted similar bills that what the Republicans want to pass here. And since those laws were enacted, those unemployment rates in those states have actually jumped well above Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania is actually a lot lower than any of the states that have these bills. So there's no evidence that it's going to bring jobs. And an argument could be made, if you're looking at real data, that unemployment's lower in states with joint and several liability like we have it.
How many states have this restriction that the Republicans are pushing through?
The bill that they're trying to push through is only in about 16 states. Even though they say 41 states have passed this type of law, that's a lie. What 41 states have done is some type of modified law, which is actually what Senator Greenlee's proposing under Senate Bill 500. And so they modified it, but not as drastic as this has gone.
Because here's my problem with this kind of stuff. You know, I know in states like that have gone with tort reform, Texas being one of them, actually medical malpractice costs have gone up. So we've seen the absolute opposite of what they were attempting to get out of it. We've seen the opposite happen. My fear is that you're going to end up having a bunch of people who are injured on the backs of the taxpayer.
And I agree with you. And that's what the Democrats were trying to do. And I think this is also important, is that what Mike Terzai has basically done is he's almost created, like, you know, some communist nation in the House where people can't introduce amendments and they can't get their, you know, free speech. Because one of the things that I know Josh Shapiro wanted to introduce as an amendment was, because people are not going to be fully compensated, is if people are not fully compensated, the state would create a victim compensation fund for those uncompensated losses. And the victim compensation fund would be paid for by the WHAM money that the legislators get.
How much of a savings, you know, are the corporation? Are they saying the corporations are going to save in all of this? I mean, because we hear these huge lawsuit awards, like the woman who spilled coffee on her, you know what? She was awarded, you know, tens of millions of dollars, ended up walking away with a couple of thousand. But we hear these big awards. How much is this in real dollars?
The savings or
the savings? What are they touting as the savings for all of this?
They're not. That's the other thing, is they cannot say how much it's going to save. One of the other amendments that the Democrats were trying to do is get mandatory, like if it's going, they say it's going to bring down insurance premiums, that the premium savings would be passed on to the consumer. And there's absolutely no number that anyone can cite as to how much it's going to be saved. And actually, if business is so bad in Pennsylvania, this was brought up yesterday, in the last 8 years, if business is so bad, why are all these Marcellus Shale companies coming in and taking over the state?
Yeah, well, again, you know, part of me thinks it's the it's those people who are pushing this.
Well, I think they are. And you, I heard before you were talking about the Tea Party with Michelle Bachmann. One of the other things I can't understand as someone who is against this, the House Bill 1 is if they're for less government and less reliance on government, why are they, why is the government trying to like tell you how juries should decide and how you get your money in the courts?
Well, because it benefits their campaign donors. Last question I've got for you. Is this even constitutional? I mean, is pushing HB1, is it constitutional?
I don't think it is, because under our state constitution, there is a ban on the ability of the legislature to enact any law that restricts your right to recover damages other than workers' compensation,
right,
immunity. And by them saying you can't recover money that you've already been determined to be entitled to from a, someone who causes, you know, whether it's sexual assault or a drunk driver, I think that's an unfair cap on damages, you know, and I think we would end up challenging it in the courts as unconstitutional down the road anyway.
What do people do to stop this?
A couple of things. One, I would, you know, just bombard your state rep and senator. And I think what people have to do is understand that these are really like made up, you know, lies that, and that's what they basically do is if you watch the House debate yesterday on the floor, the Democrats, they may not have gotten any of their amendments introduced, or even passed or anything, but one of the things they clearly made was the point that, Mike Terzai and Kurt Schroeder don't even know what's in this bill or what it does.
Well, no surprise there. They want to sell the liquor stores and they don't have a clue what they're going to get for them as well. Blind ideology. Scott Cooper, attorney and member of Pennsylvania Association for Justice. I appreciate your time, brother.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Now, until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Here's a bit of political trivia for you. Three of the goofiest, most anti-worker governors in America are named Rick. What are the odds of that? They are Scott of Florida, Snyder of Michigan, and Perry of Texas. But all three Ricardos are in danger of being out-goofified by Paul LePage of Maine. He's the right-wing extremist who slipped into the governor's chair last fall after a three-way race in which he got a mere 38% of the vote. Rather than show a bit of humility, however, this minority governor has pumped himself up with high-octane hubris and gone on a tear against the state's workaday majority. His rampage includes busting unions, rolling back child labor laws, gutting programs for the middle class and poor, and raising the retirement age for Maine workers, all in his first few weeks in office. Then, in late March, LePage made his grab for gold-plated goofy greatness. As widely reported, the potentate of the Pine Tree State ordered that a 36-foot-wide mural be removed from the State Department of Labor. The work of art depicts historical scenes of Maine workers, but it seems that the Gov and certain unnamed corporate backers found the painting too favorable toward laboring people. So, poof, it was summarily disappeared into a storeroom. With chance of put it back and recall Paul, the public has roundly ridiculed LePage as the right-wing's official decorator-in-chief. But now, he's really been stung by the U.S. Labor Department. It seems that the mural was largely paid for by a federal grant during George W. Bush's regime, and the feds are now dunning LePage's regime either to pay back the money or reinstall the artwork.
This is Jim Hightower saying, this autocrat ran against big government last year, but now he is big government and way too big for his britches. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. A great gift drops in the hot sun. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won.
You know, I look at this, and again, you know, anything that's coming out of Harrisburg right now, anything that's coming out of a lot of the state capitals across the country, not in the best interests of working people. And even, you know, even the Democrats who are supposed to be on your side sometimes are the ones jabbing me in the back as well. And I look at the fact that President Obama has declared that he's going to be opening up the southern border to Mexican trucks. Again, another one of these moments that make you go, really? Now? Is this really what we should be doing? I got a press release from Teamsters General President Jimmy Hoffa, who said union members will vigorously oppose a dangerous plan to open the border to Mexico, a country ravaged by a drug war. The U.S. DOT outlined its proposal to open the border in to Mexican trucks. And again, you know, it's going to cost us, Jake. It's going to cost us a lot of money in that we're going to do all of the monitoring. We're going to pay for the onboard electronic onboard recorders. We're going to do the drug testing. We're going to do all of the legwork and all of the infrastructure needed to get this thing passed. And we're going to end up losing in the long run because all these truck drivers who are now starving here in this country anyway because the freight's not there and there's a cutthroat competition are going to be that much worse off.
And way back in 95, I still remember the argument. Remember 94, NAFTA. When NAFTA passed, labor unions said two things. This is a bad, bad, bad bill. We're going to lose jobs, but worse, we're going to lose our autonomy. And here we are. Here we are. We gave it away
and,
for
you know,
30 pieces of silver.
And we didn't get that. We didn't get it. And you go back to these trade agreements. And again, you know, Obama's he was my guy. I voted for him. And I'll probably vote for him again in 2012 because the Republicans are insane at this point. But here we are talking about Colombia. We're talking about South Korea. We're talking about Panama. All of these trade agreements have their major downside. And not much upside for you and me, the working people. They've got an upside for the wealthy, for the very well-to-do. There is an upside for the investor class. There is an upside because you open up those countries to your investment and you secure those investments. That's the key to all of this. So when we talk about, and again, we're all over the world with our military, all over the place. We're the policemen of the world. You know why? We're policing our interests. And when you hear our interests, you know what they're talking about? The wealthy, the big corporations, not you and me. This whole thing that, oh, we're keeping the world safe. No, we're keeping the world safe for General Electric and Halliburton, not for you. It's just infuriating.
One thing I'd like to know, Rick, I mean, what's the Obama administration's official explanation of why they're supporting the Colombian Free Trade Agreement? How is that going to benefit the United States? What are their talking points?
Well, the claim is it's going to create some jobs because we're going to be able to export to them things that we already do, Caterpillar being one of the big ones, medical machinery, some of the big heavy industrial stuff, they're going to be able to get in there. So there are going to be a couple of winners. But as we're already seeing with Caterpillar, they're shifting some of their production to China. So is it really going to mean jobs in the U.S.? Not so much. What the difference in Colombia, they're saying that the president who is an ally against the Venezuelan president. So it's kind of a thumb in the eye to Venezuela as well, but it also opens up that country to our investors who are going to be able, and agribusiness, the big agribusiness in this country will have access, which the farmers in Colombia, they're not going to want the U.S. agribusiness coming in and destroying them like happened in Mexico. So this is one of those moments where the elites of both countries are going, it's good for us. Yes, yes, good for us. We can make more money. Those peasant people, we'll let them shoot each other. And the other part, I guess, is to show the business community that the U.S. under Obama will be business friendly. And as I've been saying for the longest time, what could be more business friendly than throwing trade unionists out of planes or shooting them in the head?
I believe they said the same thing to Peru, Rick, if you remember a couple of years back. And the farmers finally rioted. A bunch of them were killed because they realized they were just sent a bill of goods, and they were getting crapped on, for lack of a better word. It failed in Peru. It's going to fail here.
They were getting trickled on.
I'm trying to be nice.
And, you know, the whole cross-border trucking thing is simply the pressure that Obama felt from the people who the tariffs were put on, the agribusiness people. I mean, look, Mexico's not stupid. They knew which buttons to push in this country. You want to get something done, you go to the big agricultural businesses. You go to the farmers, not Green Acres, the guy who has got a pitchfork standing, with his family. Not, we're talking industrial farms. We're not talking something a family could ever do. We're talking industrial farms owned by multinational corporations. Those are the people who they can put their lobbying to good work for them. Understand, Mexico chose 92 products to put massive tariffs on, knowing that those special interests would get to Washington and keep the pressure on. And to Obama's credit, if I have to give him some credit on this, this has taken longer than I thought it would. I thought he would have caved last year because we were under a major, major economic downturn. But he held strong. I was hoping it would be a little bit better than this. This is bad. This is going to destroy the trucking industry. And for all of you young guys who just got into trucking, well, time for you to go look for something else. Oh, and by the way, here's some good news for all of my truck driver friends. You're going to love this because I know most of you voted for Republicans because, they believe in individual freedom and they believe in, personal liberty and all that. The extra help that came to people who lost their job through bad trade deals like NAFTA, because there was some extra help, would give you a little extra unemployment, give you some education. Well, thanks to the Republicans, they did away with that. So you get to have the liberty and the freedom to be unemployed without any help from Uncle Sam. Good for you. Good for you. Isn't it ironic how this all kind of turns around? It's just amazing to me. And look, I am being kind of a smart aleck about it, but the reality is this is what these people have done. And while Bill Clinton was the guy who passed this, it was already done. NAFTA was done long before Clinton took office. It was going to be signed. In fact, they had a date picked out for H.W. Bush to sign it. It was just a shock he lost. But, Clinton had run on it, and you knew when you voted for him. He was a free trader. He had read the book, drank the Kool-Aid, whatever. He was on board.
What I don't understand, I still remember the 2004 race, and the Democrats got Bill Clinton to stand up and say, yes, I supported NAFTA, but the way it's going and the way it's constituted now, we have to rethink it. We have to go back. We have to address the inequities. Some other leading Democrats said the same thing. President Obama said the same thing in 2008.
But turn around and look at the inequities.
And where are they?
Who got screwed the most?
Where are the changes?
No, but who got screwed the most in that deal? The Mexican people. They're the ones who really, the working class of Mexico really got the screw job. And then the working class of this
abject
country.
Poverty, Nanner.
They got pushed up to these sweatshops on the northern border in hopes that maybe they'll be able to support their family in the maquiladoras. Yeah. And then there were no jobs for them. They did what anybody would do. They crossed the border and said, hey, there might be a future there.
Well, you mentioned something. If you don't think this is about corporate power, the American corporations actually had enough power for the Mexican government to change their constitution.
Yep.
Change their constitution. The constitution used to say, as you have pointed out several times, each Mexican gets their plot of ground.
No, each community.
Each community.
Each community.
It wasn't an individual thing. It was a community.
Each community had a plot to farm.
For obvious reasons.
And those people.
To grow your own.
That's it.
They changed that constitution.
They stripped that away from them. And, again, they were able to
Monsanto and all the big agribusinesses came in.
Yep. and just they were able to sell finished product for what the Mexican farmers were able to buy the seed for. Think about that. But anyway, when we come back, I want to talk about this IKEA thing. Yesterday we talked about IKEA down at Danville, Virginia, how they're treating their employees, the whole story there. I've got Bill Street, the director of the Woodworkers Department for the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. He's down there trying to organize those employees so that they have some respect. And remember what I said yesterday, wages, hours, conditions. That's exactly all three of what these people are fighting for. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
The following message is brought to you by SEIU Local 668.
My name is Lewis. I help senior citizens get the services they need. I work for you, the taxpayers, in the Area Agency on Aging. Our senior population is growing. Their incomes are shrinking. Their need for government services is increasing, all at the same time. Funding for these services is not keeping pace, which means long waiting lists, huge caseloads, and more seniors at risk. We all know that these are tough economic times, but who wants to see our seniors suffer? They did their part. They worked hard and paid their taxes. Now it's our turn to make sure they get the services they need. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they respect our senior citizens and vote to increase funding for programs that protect them.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the wait is. Everything's raisin, but the wait is. Yes, I'm grosser than I hate is. Everything's raisin, but the wait is.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, everything is raising but the wages. And if you work down in Danville, Virginia, for the IKEA plant, evidently the wages are even going down. You know, in this story yesterday, they talked about the starting wage there went from $9.75 down to $8 an hour, which is kind of interesting since the minimum pay in one of these plants in Sweden is $19 an hour. And if you remember yesterday, we talked about the LA Times piece that said that workers had complained about eliminating raises or some of this pay, the frenzied pace and mandatory overtime. Now, remember what I talk about, wages, hours, conditions. That's the reason people join unions. That's it. Wages, hours, conditions, and some respect. And I think that, you know, you're looking at this campaign, it's obvious there's none of that there. But the guy that they quoted, Bill Street, he is the Woodworkers Department head director for the IAM, goiam.org. He was quoted in the piece, and that's why we've asked him to come and talk to us about this. Bill Street, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
You know, I look at this story, and again, you know, one of the tweets that we saw on this, it's from Good Magazine, said IKEA using U.S. for cheap labor, behaving ruthlessly, American. And you look at it, and I've been saying for the longest time, other countries like Germany and Sweden look to us like we look to Mexico or China.
Absolutely. And I don't know whether it's as ruthless as we do. I mean, we in fact will move profitable operations out of the U.S. to other countries to get other opportunities to increase profits. The IKEA folks went to Danville primarily because in their model they hate paying for transportation costs.
Right.
And so they try to put a factory in every place where they have stores. Now, once they got here, they discovered, lo and behold, they didn't have to pay the $19 an hour. They didn't have to pay the $15 an hour. They didn't have to pay the $12 an hour they told the state, the Commonwealth of Virginia, they would pay. They found out over 3 years they could start folks at $8 an hour. And then the next thing they did was they had promised everyone who was hired that there would be a standard raise progression, that every year on your anniversary date you'd get a raise. Well, when they cut the starting rate to $8 an hour, they did away with the progression and put them on a performance system where if the boss doesn't like you, you don't get a raise.
Very nice. You know, I look at the article from yesterday from the LA Times, and they quoted a woman, Ingrid Steen. She was the spokesperson for the company back in Sweden, and she said that the situation was sad and that she'd heard rumors about anti-union meetings and that, quote, this wouldn't be anything that would be approved by the group's management in Sweden. So my question is, you know, how much is this the corporation sending down an edict, and how much of this is just American management used to beating up their employees this way?
Well, as your listeners may or may not know, Danville, Virginia was the last capital of the Confederacy, and the U.S. managers at Sweadwood, Virginia act as if it still is. But that said, that doesn't get IKEA or Sweadwood off the hook. For the past 2 years, we have been telling them of these situations, of the unsafe work, of the accelerated work pace, and they've done nothing, and that's unacceptable. There is a sister mill to the Danville mill in Poland. It's a little older, but it's the exact same technology. They went into Poland and they were told by the Polish government and the Polish workers they had to have a union. So what did Sweadwood do in Poland? They helped them form the union. They come into Danville, Virginia, and the workers and the machinist union tell them, you need to recognize us so we can make sure that you have a good social partner and strong productivity and are a positive contributor to the community. And they said, you want to have a union? We're going to go out and hire one of the most anti-union law firms in the country, and we're going to fight you every step of the way. And that's what's happened. And they've lost some good people. There's very high turnover. They're relying on large numbers of temporaries, and the situation's going downhill.
And, you know, again, you know, I guess because they think that, look, there's a lot of labor out there. We can go through all of them and still have some to spare.
You know, I think that's the U.S. thinking. What I think they don't understand, and they're having production problems in Danville because they brought this Swedish technology over. They brought over Polish engineers, and then rather than attempting to form a partnership with their workers and try to hold them so they learn the sophisticated equipment, they've done Henry Ford knew, you know, you got to make a commitment to your workers for your workers to make a commitment to you.
And they've got to be able to buy your product.
And they got to be able to buy product.
So let me ask you, what's the difference between, I mean, you know, I looked at the quote from one of the Swedish union presidents in the article, and he said, you know, they've got this, you know, this plan, this code of conduct known as I-Way that guarantees workers the right to organize, stipulates that all overtime will be voluntary. Sounds like in Sweden they've got a very good relationship with the companies. What's the difference? What's the main difference in your mind between the country of Sweden and our country?
I think the principal difference is that the Swedes and most of the European Union countries understand that to get productive, profitable businesses, you must have a social dialogue and a social partnership with your employees. And in Europe, that takes the form of a trade union. And over here, the trade union movement is looked at as the enemy and is vilified. And over there, it's respected and honored. I'll tell you, I had the opportunity to live in Europe for 3 years, and I'd go to a party in Europe, and they'd say, what do? You say, well, I worked for a trade union. And it's as if you said you worked for the Red Cross. I mean, they'd all gather around you, say, that's interesting, that's exciting, what do? You go to that same party in the United States or in my home area of Bucks County, Pennsylvania, so you work for a trade union, everybody moves away from it. It's like you're a pariah.
Like you're trouble, yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me, and I think part of that has to do with the fact that American workers, I've been saying, have a form of Stockholm syndrome. They've been beaten and browbeaten and abused that they come to expect it, and if anybody's not being beaten and abused, somehow they're the one who's wrong.
That pun works on so many levels. I agree, Rick. As we've been down there 3 years now with these folks, and we did some things to show them that they weren't just victims. We got them unemployment insurance. We intervened with OSHA and decreased their injury rate. And we're working on, of course, trying to get a contract form and get recognized. But it's amazing how many workers accept bad treatment as the norm in places around the world that behavior certainly would not be treated. And I think what's going to trip up Swedwood and Danville is the concept of the family, because they have these folks working mandatory overtime, and in Virginia and in that portion of the country, in its rural America, family is very important. And when your choice is to go watch your kid play Little League baseball or get fired, it's going to crack. And I'm confident in the not too distant future we will prevail, and I'll be able to come back on the show and tell you that Danville or Swedwood in Danville, Virginia, the subsidiary of IKEA, is honoring the I-Way, and they have a machinist labor contract.
Oh, I can't wait for that day, Bill Street. And I hope you will come back. Let me ask one last question before we wrap things up. One last line of questioning, I guess. You know, we had talked earlier, and I had said that, you know, almost 80% of the people in Sweden are in a union or organized or part of a contract of some sort. And you laid out a very interesting concept, that in those countries, industries are organized, that have a master agreement, if you will, much like the National Master Freight Agreement used to be. It was an industry-wide agreement that we just don't have here in this country anymore.
That's absolutely correct. In many, if not most, of the European Union countries, they do not have what we have in the States. What we have in the States is enterprise bargaining. And so workers in a Swedwood operation in Danville, if they ever open one up on the West Coast, would be pitted against them, and every worker's pitted against every other worker in this race to the bottom. In the European model, in most of the operation countries, they have national agreements. And so what they've done as a country is they said, we are not going to allow labor rates to fall because that harms society. We cannot support free college education. We cannot support free health insurance and health care. We cannot support the quality of our life in these countries if we allow wages to fall. So companies are going to compete with each other, and they're going to compete around the world, but they're just not going to compete on the price of labor.
Yeah, and who's willing to slit each other's throat?
Right.
Let me ask you, you know, with all the We Are One rallies we're seeing around the country, what's happened in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan and all these states that are going after workers' rights here in Pennsylvania, they're talking about right-to-work legislation, or as I'm saying, the no-rights-at-work agenda. Do you see the possibility of that kind of unity that you see in a place like Sweden or Finland here on our shores ever?
Well, I have to say yes to that, or I wouldn't be a union organizer. But I will say that when people realize that the quality of their life is related to union density, and as it was from 1945 through 1980, then I think there's a possibility for those types of things to come around. When we talked earlier, you mentioned that Pennsylvania was thinking about right to work, and that got me thinking, and if you look at the most stereotypical state for right to work, the poster child is Mississippi.
Yep.
So life expectancy in the United States, the highest state is Hawaii, which, by the way, has a health care plan, 80 years. Pennsylvania's 31st. Mississippi's 50th. In terms of poverty, New Hampshire has a 7.6% poverty rate. Pennsylvania's 22nd at 12.1. 50th, Mississippi, 21%. In terms of non-farm employment over the past 10 years, California gained 6.7% in jobs, which is arguably the closest country, the state to a European Union country we have in the United States. Pennsylvania gained 2.8%, and Mississippi, with its right-to-work laws, lost 1.3%. So what is it that you think you're going to gain in Pennsylvania by going right to work when all the statistics point it's the wrong direction to go?
Well, like they said during their press conference, we're going to be able to steal jobs from Ohio and Michigan. That was one of their talking points.
Yeah, that doesn't work either. In another life, I actually was a professional economic developer for the state of Oregon, and we stole jobs from other states, and I'll tell you what happens. When you steal them and they become profitable enough, somebody else buys them and moves them.
That's all we've been seeing, this beggar thy neighbor economic development.
Yep.
It's been destroying this country. Bill Street, I appreciate the time. I wish you nothing but the best of luck. And again, I'd love to have you back on again real soon to talk about a victory.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
All right, Bill Street, thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
A sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made, American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Your working class radio experience.
Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought
are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich she had a father. Father, son, left the candy on. Head is big. Oh, he's a rocky class.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. This afternoon, President Obama said that Americans have a solemn duty and a moral obligation to help families who have members fighting overseas for our freedom. I got to be honest. My first thought when I read that is, you're just now getting this? Should this not have been the policy from day one? The second Bush sent our people into harm's way. Shouldn't we have been? I think we've been talking about this from the beginning, Jake. You have this moral obligation to make sure that the families aren't evicted from their homes, that their homes aren't foreclosed upon, that their kids can go to school and are fed. Don't you think that's kind of the basis of the whole idea at some point?
Absolutely. We have a moral pact, but if you remember Iraq, when we first sent our troops in, we were sending them over there with insufficient equipment.
Here, marshals, throw that out. They may eat them and get fat and lazy. That may harm them.
Well,
instead of bullets.
Well, I mean, we joke about it, but I can remember some families actually send pig iron over there so they could weld it under their Humvees. No. They weren't even adequately protected. I mean, we just went over there helter skelter, and we weren't totally prepared.
Well, today the Bidens and the Obamas kicked off the Joining Forces initiative to support U.S. military families. First Lady Michelle Obama developed the initiative along with Vice President Joe Biden's wife, Jill. Mrs. Obama described Joining Forces as an unprecedented national campaign to help Americans who have seen loved ones deployed multiple times to wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. She said, this campaign is about all of us, helping military families with essential items as employment, education, and better health. The First Lady also pointed out that in World War II, the whole nation went to war. And I got to be honest, this is kind of what I've been saying from the very beginning. That, you know, if we're going to have these wars, if we're going to be a war society, we support them. We get all behind it. And you know what we do? We pay for it. We do all of that. And here's where maybe my T-Twizzler friends might join in. Because I've been saying all along, we stop this all-volunteer army thing. Stop this, if you can't find a job, if you can't afford to go to college, you kind of put yourself in harm's way, so maybe you can get some college money. I said, we do away with that. We make college available to everybody. We make health care available to everybody. We disband this whole all-voluntary thing, and we make everybody join. If you really want to be like the original intent people, and this is where I think my original intent people should join me in this, do away with the entire military, have every person, every able-bodied man and woman sign up, do a year of active drills, a whole bunch of training, so that you're a ready soldier, you're part of the ready reserve, and when we decide as a nation collectively to go to war, we all go to war. Enough of this, you go off and die, and you go off and go shopping. That's not working. And I know it's never going to happen, Jake, but you know, if you really want to go back to the original intent was never to have a standing military. We were to have a standing Navy only to keep trade lines open. Because the founders, if you really want to go back to the original intent, the founders feared a standing military for the exact reason that we have right now. We're at 142 nations. That's what they feared, imperialism.
Well, I mean, the truth is, to add on to it, and I'm not arguing with you, I'm sure that's accurate. We were also a young, poor nation also. We probably couldn't afford it. If we would have decided we needed a standing army, we couldn't afford it.
Well, but at the end of it, the army was everybody. When you were attacked, everybody grabbed their musket. In fact, they passed a law, and this is one of those things that the healthcare people don't want to hear, but they actually passed a law that every male had to have a rifle, had to have a bag with a bunch of balls in it, had to have a bunch of powder, and it was a whole list of things that they had to have to be part of the militia. You know, that whole Second Amendment thing that nobody seems to bother to read the whole sentence of. That was part of it. Everybody was in the military. So that you didn't have, and this is my problem with Afghanistan, this is my problem with Iraq, this is my problem with going into Libya. The vast majority of us have no skin in the game whatsoever. We're not asked to pay for it. We're not asked to sacrifice. We're not asked to get shot at. So it's easy to go, yeah, go ahead, send those poor people over.
That was pretty much true in Vietnam, too. But if I remember, I think I'm accurate when I say this, there was only one son of a congressman that fought in Iraq. It's so easy. It's so easy to send other children's, other individuals' children to fight and die. If it was your own children, you absolutely might have second thoughts.
That's what I'm saying from the very beginning. If we're going to go to war, and war is a serious thing, if we're going to do it, we have to pay for it. We have to sacrifice as a nation. I mean, World War II was that time. My grandmother told me stories of how things were. Everybody was involved in the war effort. Everybody sacrificed. Well, everybody except the very, very wealthy. They never sacrificed. In fact, they made money off of both sides. They win no matter what. And now you're kind of seeing it. The NASCAR people, Walmart, and Major League Baseball have signed on to pledge to get the word out and do some other things with the Obamas and the Bidens to kind of, hey, we're going to support the troops because, you know, there's nothing like a good press opportunity for them. Celebrities like Oprah and Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, they have also pledged that they will help somebody. Mrs. Obama said, every business can do something. I agree. Like holding the jobs for the people who are deployed, that would be a good place to start. Not always happening. And she also said, every American can do something. Yep, I agree. Like pay for the war. Like sacrifice a little bit and not push it off and not say, oh, we need to cut now, especially those programs for those poor people. You know, our friend Rick, who's over in Afghanistan, he sent me an email recently telling me that the troops over there are not complaining about not having what they need to get their job done. That Obama has done exactly what he said he was going to do, which is to make sure that they had absolutely everything they needed. And according to our friend Rick, who's over in Afghanistan, he says they do. And, you know, I wish we would have done that from the very beginning. But again, you know, the people who pushed us into this, the people who rushed us into this, they didn't care about that.
Or even worse, you sent them into harm's way. They put their life on the line. Thousands and thousands of them come back with severe mental and emotional problems, and we, at least initially, did not take care of them. In fact, the Bush administration actually opposed a couple congressional bills which would have allocated a pretty good chunk of money to take care of those coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they actually opposed that.
And that's the thing that just drives me absolutely nuts about this whole thing.
It's totally wrong. I just can't understand it.
You know, I go back and, you know, and I've told this story before, but I've got to go through it again because I just feel that need. I go back and look, I don't have a very good image of the military. Now, the people who are serving, the people who are fighting, bleeding, and dying, those people are absolutely heroes and worth all of the accolades, the credit, whatever we want to heap onto them, I'm there with them. It's the institution that I have a problem with. And my problem is because I grew up as a kid when Vietnam was going on and when they were coming home. And I remember those soldiers coming home and being dumped back into our housing project, because understand, it's the poor who fight these things, because they're the ones who are desperate enough to say the only way to get out of this misery of a housing project or poverty is to go and put my life on the line for an opportunity. So these guys came back with broken minds, broken bodies, missing pieces, horrible drug and alcohol addictions, and they were just dumped back in our community. And as a kid, and I said this right from the beginning with Afghanistan and Iraq, as a kid, anytime I saw that big army green coat, I saw somebody who was broken and someone who was left to their own vices with no help. And I said, right when all this started, I hope and I pray that my children don't see the military and those people in the same light that I did. I hope our country takes care of those people coming home, takes care of the folks that we're calling heroes, and makes sure that they get the treatment and the opportunity that they need and deserve. And to be honest, during the Bush years, I didn't see that. Maybe, you know, with the Obama thing, well, things have gotten better, but there's more to be done. Just my thought on this.
Well, if I can make a comment, I mean, I'm at the age where I saw a lot of guys come back from Vietnam, and a good many of them partake pretty liberally over there in drugs, got into drugs, came back. A lot of them had problems. A lot of them had problems long into their life. And I think you're exactly right, Rick. I think they came back and they weren't given any help. They were just released and that was it. That was our responsibility.
I'll never forget the guy leaning up against our neighbor's house, dead on the side of the house in the month of July, wearing the heavy green jacket, with a needle in his arm. I'll never forget that. I think I was 8 years old. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dave Foster from the Blue Green Alliance. Stick around.
Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News, I'm Doug Cunningham. Capital rebellions are continuing nationwide as working people defend themselves. Jesse Russell reports.
Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and now Pennsylvania. Hundreds of supporters of collective bargaining rights descended on the Capitol building in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania yesterday to express their discontent with legislation that would make the Keystone State a so-called right-to-work state. Under House Bill 50, public and private sector employees would not be required to be a member of a union if a union represents employees at a workplace. An additional bill would prevent unions from automatically collecting dues from municipal, school district, and state employees. This wasn't the first day of protests seen by Harrisburg. Last week, the halls of the Capitol building were filled with protesters opposed to Governor Tom Corbett's proposals to slash $1.6 billion in funding for schools and the university system. Corbett is trying to address a $4 billion budget shortfall without raising any taxes. The governor made his pledge to not raise taxes during his campaign and is even considering cutting current taxes on businesses.
Activists in Washington State, inspired by Wisconsin's Capitol occupation protests, say that despite being cleared out of their Capitol occupation by police, protesters are still active in Washington and will return in larger numbers Friday. Mark Taylor Canfield is an organizer with Occupy Washington. He says Capitol protesters in Washington State want an end to some tax exemptions for corporations and the wealthy.
And they're up there right now trying to force our state legislators to consider some other options like Senate Bill 5857, which would require the state legislature to review all of these tax exemptions for corporations. I'd like to encourage people to organize and to demonstrate at their own state capital. Of course, you're doing that in Wisconsin, but we'd like to spread the news to the rest of the country to do that as well.
He says rather than balance state budgets by cutting public services needed by low-income and working people, Washington and other state governments need to end unnecessary tax exemptions that benefit the rich, so that public services can be maintained. Taylor Canfield urges protesters in all state capitals to organize resistance to these moves to balance budgets on the poor and working people, and he says that Wisconsin protesters who occupied the Capitol in Madison are inspiring and helping protesters in Washington.
So we're consulting with them and also with folks in California who are going to be marching on their state capitol this Friday. At the same time that we're going to be marching there, there's going to be a teabag party at the state capitol in Washington State and in Madison. So we're looking to get as many people as we can out there again.
This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
I'd like to go to work, but I shut it down. I got it right to go to work, but there's no work here to be found. Yes, and they say we're gonna have to pay what's owed. We're gonna have to get from some seed that's been sold. And the birds are on the wires, and the telegraph pole. They can always fly away from this rain and this cold. You can hear them all singing out, telling
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I'm sitting here in the studio with Dave Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Happy to be here, Rick.
What brings you here to Pennsylvania?
Well, we held our Pennsylvania State Summit of the 14 Blue-Green Alliance partners. You know, we're a labor and environmental partnership, 14 million members around the country, active here in Pennsylvania, kicking off our Jobs 21, Jobs of the 21st Century campaign.
You know, back in November, the Republicans ran on a platform that they were going to create jobs. I have yet to see any of that plan to actually create anything. But what you're talking about is what I had hoped they would bring, ideas that are going to create jobs. I'm a big fan of infrastructure. I'm a big fan of alternative energy. I'm hoping that's kind of why you're here and what you guys are working on.
Well, absolutely. We've seen since some of these conservatives took over in the U.S. House and around state government around the country, all they've got is a firing plan, and they've yet to announce a hiring plan to put the 30 million Americans who need jobs back to work, to say nothing about simply recapturing the 7 million jobs we lost in the current recession. So we're going to hold their feet to the fire. We're going to go out and teach our 14 million and a half members around the country how you go about creating 7 million new jobs in a clean energy economy that helps solve America's climate crisis.
You know, there was a report card done a couple years ago by the civil engineers who have rated our infrastructure as almost failing at a D, saying that we need a couple $1 trillion worth of investment because we've failed over the last 30 years to upkeep what we have and to improve upon that.
That's absolutely right, Rick. The infrastructure in America is the backbone of our economy. We let it fail. We let the American economy fail along with it. One of the great investments of the current Recovery Act were the federal matching dollars that went into rebuilding America's infrastructure, and particularly its green infrastructure. Those were some of the most effective job-creating tools we've had since the Great Depression. So, for instance, the Obama administration put money into expanding mass transit in Dallas. It leveraged private money to come in as well, $3 for every $1 of federal money, and created thousands of construction jobs. Similarly, we built new transmission lines in Montana, and we actually now are exporting clean, renewable, American-made, wind-generated electricity out of the great state of Montana up across the northern border into Canada. We're doing that because we invested in our infrastructure, and those are the kinds of investments that create jobs now, pay dividends forever.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that, makes us energy independent so we don't have to deal with going around the world, you know, the sandbox of the Middle East that we've got ourselves tied up in.
Absolutely. You know, the folks in Washington, D.C. are complaining about the federal deficit all the time. But you never hear them talk about the trade deficit, which is the big deficit that's been sucking the lifeblood out of America for the last 25 years. We have a cumulative $7.3 trillion trade deficit today that is built up over sending our factories to other countries to make stuff cheaper to come back and put Americans out of work. $2.3 trillion of that is specifically our payments to buy foreign oil to bring into this country and to make countries that hate us happy living their own lives. That's a crazy way to run an economy, and it's exactly what Jobs 21 is gearing the American people up to understand and to fight back and say, we want jobs here in America, we want to be done with this kind of economic nonsense, and we want to punish the people who took us down this path.
I'm right there with you. You know, here locally we've been talking about a rail project. They talk about Corridor 1 or whatever the latest name is. And I'm all in favor of it. I think it's going to help create jobs. It will help move people around. It'll clear up some of the congestion on the highways. But yet you've got people in leadership positions, county commissioners, who come out and say, well, it's going to cost us double, triple in taxes. It's not going to be a return on investment. I'm personally saying, you know, guys like this, visionless and really failure of leadership at any level to see into the future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what this area is going to look like without having some type of mass public transportation at the way it's exploding.
Right. If you don't invest, you never get a return. You put $0 into your infrastructure, I can guarantee that your return on investment is going to stay zero. Now, the thing about the investments that were made in the green rebuilding under the Recovery Act is that they leveraged $3 for every dollar of tax credits that we gave. $43 billion in green investment tax credits, $150 billion of private funding came along with that. Now, that's return on investment. That's how you use public money to create big private investments that in turn create jobs, create new tax revenues, solve the deficit problem, get America back to work, get our economy moving again. That's the strategy. That's how you do it. That's how you create jobs. But what conservatives are proposing today is really going to put our economy back into solid reverse.
You know, I look at, and there are some great grants and some great rebates out there for solar power right now. In fact, my wife and I are looking at putting solar panels on our house because there are some good incentives. And I've been arguing for the longest time that it's those incentives that you need to jumpstart the industry to get the volume that these companies, these private industry needs to get their product out into the marketplace and at a price low enough to where the average consumer can afford them.
Yes, I mean, it's crazy. You look at the oil industry in this country, they made somewhere in the vicinity of $900 billion in profits over the last decade, and we're still giving them tax breaks. Now, that's what I call economic insanity, is to go on giving the incentives to people who don't need it and who aren't creating jobs with it and who, in fact, are sending our hard-earned dollars out of the country to countries that hate us.
Yeah, it's just nuts. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Dave Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance. Now you've got this plan. You're going around the country pitching this to different groups. When is the action phase? When are we going to start seeing some real push for legislation and some push for
this job? Well, you're going to start seeing us bringing together our Blue-Green Alliance partners, turning their members out at a whole series of town hall meetings, demonstration events that show the strength of the green or clean energy economy that already exists, doing lots of events at the grassroots level, similar to the visit that President Obama paid last week to the Gavesa plant in Fairless Hills, Pennsylvania, showing that these are real jobs, these are blue-collar jobs, these are welders' jobs, pipe fitters, the kinds of jobs that have been the backbone of the American middle class for generations. So you'll see us doing those kinds of things. We have two high-profile co-chairs of our campaign. I know your listeners are big fans of Michelle Bachmann's back in my home state of Minnesota. Well, the woman who ran against her for Congress, former Senate majority leader in Minnesota, Terrell Clark, is co-chair of our campaign. She'll be out talking around the country about creating a strong popular movement that gives an answer on how to create jobs that the Tea Party can't come up with. Former Congressman Mark Schauer out of the Battle Creek area in Michigan, another big fan of labor and the environmental movements, champion for the clean energy economy, how we make America competitive again, create jobs that ought to be here in America that currently are ending up in China. So we're going to be out stumping, holding those kinds of events. We're going to identify 1 million clean energy voters between now and 2012. Those folks are going to be with us to help create a network of activists who will put the clean energy economy front and center in the American public policy discussion.
Yeah, I have to be honest, you know, listen to what you've said and some of the reading that I've done on this. I can't imagine that anyone would be against it. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. It's not a right-left. It shouldn't be a political issue. It just seems like smart policy that you want to build things domestically, you want to be energy independent, because I truly believe the country that wins this war to energy independence is going to be dominant in the 21st century. It just makes common sense. Look, $4 a gallon for gas, we're just there.
That's right. There's a finite supply of fossil fuel in the world today. There's growing economic competition over who controls that. The smart answer out, the innovative answer out of the predicament is the clean energy economy. And you're right, the country that wins the race to develop the technologies of the future will be the biggest beneficiaries of jobs of the next generation. So as I've said many times before, China created 1 million jobs in the renewable energy industry in 5 years, went from 0 to 70 in a short period of time. Those are jobs that could and should have been here in America. We were the inventors of clean energy technology. We gave it away to the rest of the world. We don't want to be the leaders. I say it's time for us to have people in Washington, D.C. who understand that the big economic development strategy of the 21st century is going to be clean energy innovation. Let's go get it now. Let's bring it home.
Last question I've got for you. You know, one of my greatest fears is that we're reliving 1980 again. Mm-hmm. You had Jimmy Carter, who had a lot of very innovative ideas in getting us off the juice, getting us towards clean energy, a lot of incentives. And what you had in 1981, Reagan came in, tore the solar panels off the White House, basically sending that shot across the boardroom saying we're going back to oil. What I'm afraid of is we've done all these steps that we're going to get down to the next election, and someone's going to come in and undo all of they are small steps forward, but undo even those.
Well, that's why we're starting now. I'm a big believer that the American people stand for self-reliance. They stand for taking responsibility for their own lives and being strong advocates for a better future for our children. And all of those things are coming to play right now. We can't blame this problem on anybody. We all know what it is, so let's get out and be active about it. Let's create a movement for the jobs of the 21st century.
And to get involved, where would they go?
They need to go to the Blue Green Alliance website, www.bluegreenalliance.org. Sign up. We'll get them involved.
And we will put a link at therichsmithshow.com. Dave Foster, great talking to you. I look forward to the next big Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference that you guys put on in Washington. Always an informative time.
Great. We'll see you next year.
All right, Dave. Thanks. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Together, the Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make things, we make happen.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Landline Magazine. It's basically a transportation magazine for truckers. Evidently, the state of Texas, they are pushing through a bill that would up the speed limit to 85 miles an hour. They're also going through pushing a bunch of these public-private partnerships to do road work as well. Now, you know, you're going to push it up to 85 miles an hour. This is their goal. And look, you know, I don't know if you've been up and down the roads here. People are doing 80, 85 miles an hour here, and the speed limit's 65. You jack that up to 85, you're going to have people doing 100, 110 miles an hour. And, you know, for me, you know, just like we were talking with Dave Foster a minute ago, the problem that I have with that is not that people will be doing 85 miles an hour, is that our infrastructure is crud. We've got some real problems. You hit a major size pothole in a road doing 85 to 100 miles an hour, there is very little room for error there. So, you know, is part of this raise going to come with, oh, I don't know, maybe fixing the roads? You know, I was watching this thing over the weekend, Jake. It was on our infrastructure, and it was on the History Channel, the crumbling of America. And they were going around the country to all of these different bridges, which are main key thoroughfares through different areas that you can actually stand in the middle of the road and peer down into the water below. And, you know, every time I go over this bridge here in Harrisburg, you know, I sit and I go, you know, it's a long way down. Could this be the next I-35 where we end up in the drink? And they talked about at length the Tappan Zee Bridge there in New York. And I used to spend hours sitting on the Tappan Zee Bridge because, you know, that's where we used to run up into New England from. And you would sit on that bridge, and you would feel it move. And anybody who's been on it and has sat on traffic in it, you would move like 6 inches. I mean, and you find out that it's on wood pilings, that now they've got this predator that's down there eating the wood. So basically it's being, you know, they got water termites or something down there eating these wood pylons off. Eventually they're saying it is going to collapse.
Well, it talked about, if it's the same show, I think it was, they talked about the collapse of the bridge in Minnesota.
The I-35 bridge.
The irony is he brought on Ed Rendell, and Ed Rendell said, you know, when we came out of the Eisenhower administration, you know, that socialist president, as you like to call him, kiddingly.
He was a socialist. He was a socialist. He built the interstate with public money.
Well, you know, you talk to a Republican and that's heresy, but that subject aside, the serious subject is that coming out of the Eisenhower administration in 1961, we were spending 12% of our income into the government on infrastructure. Now, you know what we're spending? Between 2 and 2.5. Now, conversely, our economic competitors worldwide, China and India, you know what they're spending annually? 8%. Almost 4 times what we're spending, and then we wonder why we have problems with crumbling infrastructure.
Well, what we've got,
for decades, we've neglected it.
What we've got is a Republican Party who is bent on this idea that we need tax cuts at all costs. Tax cuts are all we need. Because, of course, we know that tax cuts pave roads and tax cuts, you know, build bridges. And what we're doing now is even worse. We've come up with this new great thing, and it really started just before the Clinton years, but Clinton was one who used it a lot, this idea of a public-private partnership. Basically what that means, for the people in the cheap seats, we're going to take public money, we're going to give it to private corporations, and they're going to build something, and they're going to profit from it. That's basically what a public-private partnership is. We're going to take public money, give it to a private interest. They're going to benefit from it, and we're just going to be left holding the bag. But we'll get to be able to have the service and pay for it again.
And pay more.
And pay more. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing, as you were saying, Rendell, 12% of our income should be going to building an infrastructure. And they had talked about the civil engineer's report card. And, you know, you look at the grades that we got in 2009, and things have not gotten much better since 2009. Nothing above a C+. Nothing. And that's our handling of solid waste, our trash pickup. Got a C+. The Ds, aviation, dams, drinking water, hazardous waste, inlet waterways, levees, roads, schools, transit, water, wastewater, all got Ds. Our C's, we got a C on bridges, a C on public parks and recreation, a C on rail, and that C+, of course, that high mark there on there on solid waste. A D plus for energy. So we got a D plus, stepping in the right direction. The problem is we haven't had the vision, Jake. We haven't. And rail is something that we should be investing in. No. Roads and bridges, something we should be investing in. They say we need about $2.5 trillion in investment. Do you think that's going to come out of the Ryan budget? Do you think they're going to look to the future and say, you know what, we need to invest some tax dollars there to build roads and bridges? Of course not.
We don't have enough programs that the Republicans can cut to save that much.
Maybe it's a matter of priorities. Maybe we can pave the roads with those greedy geezers.
Well, okay. Are you insinuating that I'm one of them? All kidding aside, I mean, I don't know that we've even mentioned water and gas line pipes. I mean, some of these water pipes are 100 years old or more.
Yeah, I mean
we got some serious, serious problems out there. Yep. And so far, we've been lucky. We've been lucky. I mean, look what happened down in Reading. I don't know that that was a matter of aged pipe, but it could very well.
You mean in Allentown?
Was it Allentown?
Yeah, the house blew up, okay. And five died?
Yeah, a bunch of people died.
Yeah. That was Allentown. And, you know, the thing is, when I lived in Allentown, that kind of stuff happened more frequently than not. I remember, you know, and I've told this story before, as you know, in kind of just relaying my sleeping prowess, because I used to be, before children, a very good sleeper. one of those pipes had blown up at, you know, near a senior center a couple of blocks from our apartment. And it actually blew a window out of our apartment. And I woke up several hours later with glass all over my bed.
And you didn't know
slept
it.
Slept right through it.
Wow.
Like a baby. But anyway, this whole infrastructure thing, something we should be, the federal government has to take the lead on. This is not something we should be leaving to the states. This is something, much like Eisenhower did, say, you know what, we're going to have an overall plan on how we're going to move people across borders, across the country, how we're going to move goods and services. This is something for the federal government to do. Leaving Wisconsin to have the choice to put in a rail line should not be left to them. We shouldn't be investing in a rail line in Pennsylvania if Ohio is not going to hook up to it to get us over to Indiana. You can't go around Ohio. This is where the federal government has to say, you know what, we're putting a rail line across the country. Everybody's going to do it because we're going to have a train that runs across, and we're going to put a couple up and down, and people are going to be able to get around. We need to have a sustainability of revenue. We need to have a resilience. We need to be consistent. We can't say, okay, well, there's a crisis, let's throw up a whole bunch of money, and then walk away from it. And we need to have a plan. I mean, at some point, you know, this invisible man who, you know, the invisible hand keeps moving around, it ain't working. It's just not working. And you look at the reality is we need to start replacing things when they need to be replaced. You know, I was reading something that said our grid has a 40-year life, was built for a 40-year lifespan. We're already into 42 years, and there's no plans of replacing it. Bridges were made for 50, these certain bridges were made for 50 years. We're already 60 years into their life. And we absolutely need to increase and improve our investment. It is that simple. And yet all we hear out of the Republicans, all we hear, cut, 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 cut. No investment, no education, no health care, cut.
And very little advice on how to cut down on reliance on oil. And here we are, not doing anything to improve our roads. It's, wow, it's a lose-lose unless we change.
What I've said from the very beginning, I'm worried about the deficit a little bit. I'm worried about the debt a little bit. I'm more worried about our trade deficit. And if you look at, Reuters had reported that the U.S. trade deficit had shrank in February as both imports and exports fell, according to government reports. What they're saying is it suggests a slowdown in the government, in the global demand. But here's the thing. The trade gap was $45.8 billion. In the month of January, 45.8. In the month of February, that number had gone to, 45.8. In January, it was 44.5. So here we are over $90 billion in 2 months. Last year at this time, it was $74 billion in trade deficit. So as the economy has recovered, we are growing our trade deficit. And year after year, what we keep seeing is China kicking our butts. China kicking our butts. And Scott Paul had an interesting comment. He's the executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. And this is something I think people need to hear. And it's kind of along the lines of what I've been talking about. He says Washington has focused a lot on budget deficits this year, but scant attention has been paid to the trade deficit. That must change. The trade deficit serves as a drag on GDP growth and requires financing just like any other debt. He says, while only 9.5% of our debt is financed by China, that nation is responsible for fully 70% of our trade deficit in non-oil goods. So basically what he's saying is what I've been saying all along. Cut down on the amount of trade we're doing with China. Make them either buy more of our stuff or start cutting them off. But we're getting our hats handed to us. We are absolutely getting our hats handed to us as they're eating our lunch. And yet, all we keep hearing Republicans talk about, cutting the deficit, cutting the debt. Never mind that trade thing. Why? Because it's their people who are benefiting from this trade situation. I looked at the Journal of Commerce. They're saying that U.S. containers, the import for U.S. containers has grown by 9% in April. This is the 15th, and this is how it reads. The Journal of Commerce, Port Tracker projects 15th consecutive month of improvement. Containerized imports at U.S. ports in April are projected to increase by 9% over April of 10, which would mark the 15th consecutive month over year-over-year improvement in the U.S. container trade. So for them, the more containers we get in, the more product that comes in from overseas, the better things are for them. Not for us, because every one of those containers that come in are products that we should have been making. That's the reality. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back after this with Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Here's a bit of political trivia for you. Three of the goofiest, most anti-worker governors in America are named Rick. What are the odds of that? They are Scott of Florida, Snyder of Michigan, and Perry of Texas. But all three Ricardos are in danger of being out-goofified by Paul LePage of Maine. He's the right-wing extremist who slipped into the governor's chair last fall after a three-way race in which he got a mere 38% of the vote. Rather than show a bit of humility, however, this minority governor has pumped himself up with high-octane hubris and gone on a tear against the state's workaday majority. His rampage includes busting unions, rolling back child labor laws, gutting programs for the middle class and poor, and raising the retirement age for Maine workers. All in his first few weeks in office. Then, in late March, LePage made his grab for gold-plated goofy greatness. As widely reported, the potentate of the Pine Tree State ordered that a 36-foot-wide mural be removed from the State Department of Labor. The work of art depicts historical scenes of Maine workers, but it seems that the Gov and certain unnamed corporate backers found the painting too favorable toward laboring people. So, poof! It was summarily disappeared into a storeroom. With chance of put it back and recall Paul, the public has roundly ridiculed LePage as the right-wing's official decorator-in-chief. But now, he's really been stung by the U.S. Labor Department. It seems the mural was largely paid for by a federal grant during George W. Bush's regime, and the feds are now dunning LePage's regime either to pay back the money or reinstall the artwork. This is Jim Hightower saying, this autocrat ran against big government last year, but now he is big government and way too big for his britches.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com and now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
The president's midday speech.
His midday speech, he's going to be focused on the fiscal commission on debt. He's going to be talking about how to deal with debt. He will be talking about sunsetting the tax cuts, freezing federal spending, which, of course, he's already spoken about. The White House was very unclear about what he's planning on doing on Social Security. Says that he will actually be able to save $4 trillion over the next 10 years. And, of course, a lot of this on Social Security, even though he wasn't saying this, is to raise the minimum wage. And again, the White House was very unclear as to whether how much he was going to address Social Security. A lot of this is basically based on the Bowles-Simpson report.
Yeah, I'm really afraid of that report.
Well, a lot of reasons to be afraid. And in fact, I think you and I talked about this, but the Progressive Caucus has their own budget plan that they're revealing, including an increase in taxes, an increase in corporate tax rates, and an end to subsidies for places like the oil company.
What zero tax rate isn't high enough for you, Ellen?
Well,
come on.
You know, gee, they make billions and they haven't paid a cent.
You know, it is what it is. So the Gang of Six in the Senate, again, we got to deal with this?
Well, again, we have to deal with it, and it looks like they're going to hold sway. On the Democrat side, we have Warner, which is Virginia, Durbin of Illinois, Conrad of North Dakota, Republican side, Saxby Chambliss, Coburn, Tom Coburn. He's also a doctor. And Crapo. So that's really where these guys are coming from, and they've gotten together, and it looks like a lot of what they're doing, the Bowles-Simpson report.
It seems like there's a lot of movement towards the Bowles-Simpson report.
Very much so, and I guess that's because it's the middle. And as you know, a lot of their recommendations they didn't do because 13 out of the 15, I think they needed 13 out of the 15 or 13 out of the 16 people who are on the commission to actually make a recommendation.
I thought it was 14, but you're close enough.
Well, whatever it is, yeah, it was a lot of folks.
So what are they trying? What's the Progressive Caucus? What's their plan in this?
Well, again, their plan is the tax issue, to really go after this issue of the corporate taxes and all of the kinds of loopholes there are, and also in terms of trying to increase taxes, particularly over people that make $1 million, but pretty much anybody over $250,000, and trying to say that this is very important to do.
So going back and looking at Schakowsky's bill of a couple of weeks ago.
That's exactly where they're aiming. And they're trying to take a look at people like Kucinich and Jan Schakowsky and saying, look, these people have a lot to offer. They are dealing with constituencies of working people. And this is important.
Yeah, at the end of the day, before we start slashing billions from education and billions from health care, and we start making people work longer, maybe those who are doing really well could contribute a little bit more. And I'm not saying we don't have a debt problem, and I think the president does see that we have a debt problem, but I also believe we've got a revenue problem.
That's right. Well, it is a revenue problem, and it's also a revenue problem. And to look at all these deficit-cutting things and not look at taxes is just insane. Particularly when you have a place like GE or a lot of these other companies, Exxon, that are getting subsidies, or a lot of the farm subsidies. What are people who are working in the steel mills or did work in the steel mills getting?
Yep, I'm right there with you. Capitol Police arrested a protester?
Well, that's right. Actually, yesterday, the mayor of D.C. was arrested by the Capitol Police. About half the city council members were. Eleanor Holmes Norton, the representative, said, well, she wanted to make it a people's thing, and so she didn't get arrested. It's hard to arrest a member of Congress when you're the congressional police officers. But our very own Jay Tamboli was kind of sitting there watching things. He got arrested. They have a very odd law that you need to have fingerprints. The fingerprint machine was doing one about every 25 minutes. and therefore he actually spent the night in jail with a member of the city council, our very own Jay Tamboli, who's an attorney.
So did he? Oh, I'm sure there's going to be a suit over this.
Oh, I'm sure there is, and I haven't spoken to Jay, but I think he already is thinking about. I mean, he's a member of the D.C. and Maryland bar.
And if he's a member of your group, I would assume he's a member of the press.
He is a member of the press. I said, didn't you flash your press credentials? He said it didn't do any good.
Jeez, oh man.
Capitol Police.
Wow. It is.
And he was literally sitting there in the middle. He wasn't part of it. Capitol Police just rounded everybody up.
Wow.
Now, it's very interesting because the Capitol Police, you know, Congressman Bob Ney used to be in charge of it for government oversight. So we know because Bob now works for us after he got out of jail. But what's so amazing about that is here you have these guys who are sort of running office, and clearly it's the Republicans. So they had no flies on them. They were going to arrest the D.C. mayor.
Everything. Amazing stuff. So on Friday they came up with their continuing resolution, as I understand. They're having some problems, though, getting it passed.
Well, that's right. Well, they got the continuing resolution for 8 days, but now they're trying to get the continuing resolution to the end of September. As you know, there was a quote-unquote agreement on that, and the House has postponed that vote till Thursday, which makes me wonder if they don't have the numbers to get it. The very hard right, such as the Tea Party people and people like, this is in the Senate, Sanders, but a lot of the hard left, as we would say, are enjoined with the hard right, and they don't want to pass it.
Well, I'm going to be honest. If I were in Congress, I don't know that I would want to. I would have to say, look, before we start talking about cutting food stamps, WIC programs for women, infants, and children, I say that those who are doing well should contribute a little bit more.
Well, that's absolutely the issue, and that is where, people like Dennis Kucinich and others are just furious.
So the reborn birther candidate, I hear he's considering being reborn again.
Ha! I guess so.
As I've heard, he's going to be an independent.
Yes. Trump is thinking of being an independent. And what's very interesting is that I think he knows he can't get the Republican vote. I think he wants to do a very strong vote. I mean, look at Perot, 19% of the vote the first time around. And the other thing that we have is Gary Johnson, a former governor of New Mexico, socially liberal, in favor of gay marriage, very conservative financially, is thinking of running for president. He will make some announcement, which we assume is that he's in on Thursday.
Well, that should be interesting to see.
This
whole 2012 thing is gearing up, and I'm excited about it. And hopefully, we will be there in New Hampshire to bring our listeners.
Well, we always have a large radio row in New Hampshire. We're also probably going to be in Iowa. We hope to also see you at the convention.
We would love to be there. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks for your time. See you tomorrow.
Thank you.
And now to find out what's going on here. What do you got for us?
Yeah, an interesting poll came out, Rick, concerning President Obama. Just today, not many of the potential Republican candidates for president, however, in 2012 are particularly well-liked in Pennsylvania, and that's still not good enough news for President Obama. A new poll released today signals that the swinging Keystone State could prove troublesome for the Democratic president, even against a field of Republicans that so far promises primary runs from Newt Gingrich, your girlfriend Michelle Obama, Rick, and the country's newest big birther, Donald Trump.
My girlfriend Michelle Obama?
Did I say Obama? Yes. Michelle Bachmann, I'm sorry.
Ah, Michelle Bachmann.
I'm sorry I insulted your girlfriend.
I'm confused at what that meant. Is Michelle Bachmann my girlfriend that you've insulted, or Michelle Obama?
No, Michelle.
Who got insulted?
Michelle.
Who was insulted?
Michelle Bachmann.
She was insulted for being...
Well, I'm being facetious.
I'm missing the facetiousness.
I didn't... we'll talk about it later. According to public policy polling, Pennsylvania is beginning to look like it could be a tough state for Obama in 2012, even though we're still about a year and a half away. His approval rating here is only 42%, with 52% of voters disapproving of him. Obama is within the range of error in the state against three potential Republican opponents, Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum. That's a far cry from the double-digit victory in the state in 2008. What has to be concerning for Obama beyond those top-line numbers is that the Republican poll completely with him, despite the fact that they themselves are not well-liked, according to PPP poll servicer Tom Jensen. Huckabee's net favorability is a -6 spread, and Romney and Santorum are both at -10 points. The fact that
Obama!
The fact that they tie Obama without being all that appealing makes you wonder how much trouble the president will be in here if the party's nomination process actually does result in a strong candidate. Pennsylvania is back to looking red heading into the 2012 election cycle. Republicans, as you know, Rick, control the state House and Senate, and Governor Tom Corbett won the governor's post handily over Democratic Dan Honorato. Senator Pat Toomey nudged former Rep. Joe Sestak to take Arlen Specter's seat. Obama has two major problems in the state, independent and white Democrats. A majority of independents disapprove of him, 54% give him bad marks, to 39% who thinks he's doing a good job. More concerning is his approval rating with Democrats. It's only 68%, which is well below the 81% nationally. And if I can just make a comment on that, even though these numbers might not be all that good, but at this point, I don't see the Republicans with a strong candidate. Now, again, it's a year and a half off, and that could change, but as of now, I don't see the Republicans coming in this state winning this state. Pennsylvania House approves expansion of Castle Doctrine. We talked about this several times. With the Republicans in control, there have been several attempts, and now they're back at it again. I think there was a bill passed last year, and I think the governor, the Democratic governor at that time, Rendell, he vetoed it. State House lawmakers approved a measure today that would expand a citizen's right to use lethal force in cases of self-defense. The State House voted 164-37 to advance a proposal by State Rep. Scott Perry, who's a Republican from Dillsburg, that permits the use of deadly force without first having to retreat anywhere a citizen has a legal right to be if he feels his life or safety is in danger. Current law allows for that right inside a person's home. Perry's bill expands that to include vehicles, workplaces, and other public areas, which to me is a step further. Critics argue that the bill could be used by criminals as a defense and that would invite more violence than already exists, particularly in cities. The bill now heads to the state Senate for consideration. A similar measure by State Senator Richard Alloway, Republican, Franklin County, was approved by the Senate last month. As I had said previously, the legislature approved an expansion of the state's Castle Doctrine last year, but it was vetoed by then-Governor Ed Rendell, and my first reaction is if it passes the House and the Senate, I think it's a good chance that Governor Corbett will sign it.
No, he's already said he's going to sign it.
Okay.
Not a good chance, it's a certainty.
That's no surprise to me, given the tenure of the political attitudes. Fair Pay Act would bring equal pay for equal work. Today, as equal rights advocates mark Equal Pay Day to remind the nation that women are paid just 80 cents for every dollar men earn, Senator Tom Harkin introduced the Fair Pay Act of 2011 that would ensure that employers provide equal pay for jobs that are equivalent in skill, equivalent in effort, responsibility, and working conditions. Harkin says that discrimination accounts for much of the pay gap, and there are too many loopholes and barriers to effective enforcement of existing laws. Quote, we need to strengthen penalties and give women the tools they need to confront discrimination. Commentator Debbie Hines writes in an op-ed news.com, women's salaries are outpaced by men almost everywhere, from the highest paying occupation to the lowest paying occupations. Everywhere from doctors and lawyers to cashiers and lesser positions, women earn less than their male counterparts. The Fair Pay Act would also require employers to publicly disclose their job categories and their job skills without requiring specific information on individual workers. Under current law, women who believe they are the victim of pay discrimination must file a lawsuit and endure a drawn-out legal discovery process to find out whether they make less than the man working beside them. It took Lily Ledbetter nearly 20 years before she discovered she was being paid less than men doing the same job and was able to file suit. After the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against her in 2007, Congress passed the Lily Ledbetter Pay Act that helped level the playing field for victims of wage discrimination. Thank you. But President Obama signed in 2009. On this Equal Pay Day, let us make sure what happened to Lily never happens again by recommending to eliminate discrimination in the workplace and make equal pay for equal work a reality, to which I say amen. Ohio Governor Kasich. I mean, nothing surprises me, but there's a report coming out of Ohio that I think he might have outdone himself on this one. Just when you thought the political pandering, the corporate greed could not get any worse, Ohio Governor John Kasich has taken it to a new low, which is pretty low. Hidden deep in the proposed budget is a provision to allow his administration to contract out for 75 years. Let me repeat that. It would allow his administration to contract out for 75 years any state service to any applicant that the state budget and management director, a Kasich employee, appointee, by the way, alone deems qualified. The winning contractors would pay no business tax on gross receipts or on any income from providing public services, not to mention the thousands of jobs that could be lost. The provisions are tucked away between pages 261 and 266 in Kasich's proposed budget and do not require that the winning bidder be current on taxes, does not require that they operate a safe workplace, or that they would pay a legal wage or even be an Ohio company that employs Ohioans. Nor is there anything to stop Kasich's cronies from awarding contracts to major Kasich campaign contributors. And nobody, not even the state's controlling board, which oversees state contracts, would be able to review the deal. Innovation Ohio, a progressive think tank headquarters in Columbia, today presented Kasich with its taxpayer rip-off of the week award for those secret sick pages of the budget. With these secret sick pages, the governor's proposed budget takes taxpayer ripoff to a whole new level. They transform the OBM director into an unaccountable modern day czar. And there you have it.
There we go.
Governor Kasich at work.
Well, let's take a quick break back after this.
Away from the city, the noise and crowds, the freeway ride. But they slashed our funding, they cut all our hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a comma? How did the fall become all mine? The president says, I'm tightening the belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888. 888.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new Constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Funny free with the change all around. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
You know, one of my favorite places to go used to be Applebee's. Jake, we spent a lot of time sitting around the local Applebee's.
Soup and salad.
Yes. Yeah, well, no. I don't remember what we got, but we used to spend a lot of time there. A story has popped out that that just grabbed me, and it made me laugh. Evidently, one of their suburban Detroit locations, somehow the orders got mixed up somehow. Something bizarre happened, and they gave a 15-month-old toddler who was supposed to get apple juice. Little Dominic was supposed to have apple juice. Turns out he got a margarita. and mom said, you know, she realized something was wrong when little Dominic kind of laid his head down on the table and dozed off a little bit and then woke up and got really happy. The little boy reportedly began hailing strangers and saying, "Hey, how are you?" and carrying on and being the happy drunk that now he will turn into, because at 15 months, he got loaded.
That's funny, but it's a certain sense it's not.
I got to be honest, if it was my 15-month-old, I'd be flipping mad. But then again, you know, I go back to it. I remember when my great-grandmother used to babysit me. Do you remember those little airplane bottles of booze? That was great-grandma's little helper. She used to give that to me, and here, go take a nap.
Do you remember that?
No, my mother told me the story where they found me behind the couch, between the wall and the couch, passed out with the little bottle of liquor next to me.
I'm sorry, Rick. I got to laugh at that.
That's funny stuff. Come on. You got to laugh at that kind of stuff.
How old were you at the time?
I was probably 3 or 4 years old.
Oh, my.
Yeah, pretty funny. Pretty funny stuff. At least, you know, I think it was. But nowadays, it's a federal crime, and I'm sure, you know, the people at Applebee's are going to be sued for that mix-up. I'm sure there'll be, you know, a $100 million lawsuit. And maybe it's right, because now the kid's got a predisposition to alcoholism. Because he was happy. He laid his head down, took a little nap, and then woke up very happy.
He was a happy drop.
There you go.
Well, that is a positive.
Good for him. You know, I was going to get into a whole story now about this Boeing, this WTO ruling on the Boeing thing. That's probably just going to have to wait till tomorrow, because I can't get over the kid who got all liquored up at the Applebee's. Drunk and hungover, you know. In fact, you know, if we're 2 nights in a row now, we're talking about drinking stories. You know, look what you've done. This is your fault. Or the people at Applebee's were serving a 15-month-old a margarita in a Happy Meal cup. I mean,
how did that happen?
I have no idea.
In a Happy Meal, I could understand if it was two adult drinks that got mixed.
No, they give you those little cups, little plastic cups that the juice and the milk are supposed to come in, because we've got a bunch of them at the house. And somehow they must have decided, hey, it's a great idea, put margarita in this little plastic cup with the lid on it. Beautiful.
Wow.
Just beautiful. But, you know, I've got a picture. You know, my uncle babysat me once. Another huge mistake. I was about 7 or 8. And there's a picture of me. I drank 3 Miller High Lifes and fell in the sink full of dishwater.
3 Miller at what age?
I was 7.
Ooh. Oh, that's way too much for a 7-year-old.
Nah, not for me. I had a high tolerance. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests for being here. Thank you for being here. And thank Brett, our chief engineer, for sliding the tubes. We'll see you tomorrow night.
It's coming from the wind.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the bitter sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Well, they're stealing down on Wall Street and in Washington, too. You know, it makes me wonder, what's a guy on Main Street to do? Always tried to be an honest, upstanding kind of guy. And I must admit lately, I thought I...